somewhere I read, of the freedom of speech.
Et qui défendait la liberté d'expression.
The moment you limit free speech, it's not free speech.
Somebody will say, oh, freedom of speech, freedom of speech. These are foolish people.
Welcome to Clear and Present Danger, a history of free speech by Jakub Mshangama.
Clear and Present Danger relies on the generous support of FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, Fridor, and the Politiken Foundation. Episode 37, Expert Opinion, The History of Mass Surveillance with Andreas Marklund. In 2013, the NSA contractor Edward Snowden sent shockwaves through the American government when he leaked information exposing a number of vast mass surveillance programs, providing the US government and allies access to global digital communication networks. The harvesting of data has been aided by the vast data collection by big tech companies like Google and Facebook, whose business models rely on knowing more about their users than their users know about themselves. The combination of state and corporate mass surveillance of the digital sphere has obvious consequences for both freedom of expression and information. Private conversations are rarely ever truly private, and the centralization of communication platforms allows both governments and corporations to censor and control the flow of information. This development has changed public perception of the digital age from one of unlimited freedom, promise, and possibilities to cynicism, fear, and paranoia. But the age of mass surveillance was not ushered in with the internet. In fact, just as today, mass surveillance was dominated by the leading liberal democracy of its day when Great Britain laid the foundation at the outbreak of World War I. And as in the 21st century, the issues that drove the push for mass surveillance and censorship at scale was national security and fears of extremism, disinformation, and propaganda. With me to discuss the history of mass surveillance and its consequences for free expression and information is Andreas Marklund, who is the head of research at the Enigma Museum of Communication in Copenhagen. Andreas, thank you very much for speaking with me today.
Thank you for inviting me.
So throughout this podcast, I've often been struck by how all the burning issues relating to free speech and censorship mirror similar developments of the past. And your research on mass surveillance is probably the most striking example of this, because we tend to think of our digital age as completely unique, you know, posing unprecedented challenges to humankind that we, you know, had never thought about before. But as we'll see, that's probably not the case. But first of all, could you give us a definition of mass surveillance, how it differs from ordinary surveillance, and when the era of mass surveillance began?
Yeah, what is surveillance? What is ordinary surveillance? And what is mass surveillance? Mass surveillance, to me, my definition would be that it is surveillance at an aggregated scale, surveillance of complete populations, or at least complete communications systems, not conducted as, you know, targeted operations or, you know, operations against specific groups and so on, or sample tests, but, you know, surveillance aimed at entire societies, yeah. Basically. For instance, through various kinds, and then through various kinds of blanket methods, all encompassing methods, such as, you know, the reading of all letters, or, you know, the wiretapping of all telephone conversations, or interception of all telegrams.
Yeah.
That would be mass surveillance to me.
Yeah.
And that is a child, I would say, of the era of mass war, a child of the 20th century. You had more targeted kinds of surveillance during the 19th century, for instance, and even before that. I mean, yeah. Secret reading of letters, opening of letters was a part of, you know, royal absolutism. That's how the absolute kings of Europe ruled in, you know, early modern times.
Yeah.
But it was still more targeted. It was not blanket surveillance in the sense that you get in during the 20th century.
And in the 20th century, the game changer is World War I, as I understand it. So what's so special about
World War One, because it's really, as I understand it, it's a perfect storm of, as you said, a total war, but also recent technologies that come together to create the perfect storm and lay the ground for mass surveillance.
Yes, exactly. The perfect storm of Britain. I mean, Britain actually experimented with, you know, mass surveillance during the Second World War, late 19th century, 1899 to 1902. But it was by the outbreak of World War One that they really implemented this global mass surveillance system. We had to remember that Britain was, you know, a hegemonic superpower within the field of transnational communications at that time. I mean, 60% of the global communications infrastructure, 60% of the global transoceanic telegraphic cables were owned by Britain. And the British used this system systematically during World War One for first intercepting signals that were, you know, strategically useful for the British war effort. But they also used it in order to counter German espionage and to counter all kinds of, you know, economic activity that could be harmful for the Allied cause. And that system was actually built up already during in the first days of August 1914, wow, when orders were sent out from the Home Secretary to various cable stations, telegraph stations all around the globe owned by the Brits, and of course to the British Post Office, who was the office that was responsible for the domestic communications. And very discreet British cable sensors showed up at all these key points in the, you know, global communications infrastructures, having orders to, you know, keeping a very close eye on all kinds of messages that passed through British cables.
So this would be primarily telegraphs that were intercepted, or were there other kinds of technology?
Primarily telegrams, yeah, because the telegraph was, you know, the main technology for global transnational communication, yeah,
it was
at
internet,
that time.
The internet of the day.
Yes, exactly. The Victorian or Edwardian internet, so to speak. Of course, you had wireless technology as well, but that was very, that was a technology that was in its infancy back then. It was a very embryonic technology, and it was heavily restricted by the outbreak of war. The big thing with, you know, communication surveillance during World War One, I mean, what I call the first mass surveillance system, was that it was aimed against what I would call, with an academic buzzword, transnational communication. That was the big thing. I mean, communication flows crossing national borders.
Mm-hmm. So not so much aimed at communication within the UK, for instance, but everything that
passed through UK British, yeah, borders. And of course, as Britain had, you know, a global empire, British borders were basically everywhere, in a way.
Maybe it's self-explanatory, but so 60% of these cables the Brits have access to. But how does this affect the free flow of communication and censorship? What would the Brits do? Would they read everything? Would they withhold information? Was it more of a passive or an active form of monitoring and censorship?
Both, I would say. First of all, they had these cable sensors who checked the content of all telegrams. I mean, hundreds of thousands of telegrams passing through British cables. And everything that was deemed to be, you know, suspicious was put aside, maybe delayed. If it was, you know, slightly suspicious, it was, you know, really suspicious. You know, the sender and the intended recipient, they were put on a blacklist, a specific watch list. And then the telegram would probably be forwarded to some kind of intelligence agency. They had a number of different intelligence agencies in Britain handling suspicious kinds of information. They had Room 40, which was the Intelligence Bureau of the British Admiralty. And of course, you had MI5 and MI6, for instance. But you also had, you know, special offices within the Trade Ministry and the Foreign Ministry dealing with, you know, trade issues, trading with the enemy, that kind of intelligence. So it was used for various kinds of purposes. I think I read somewhere that, you know, the information collected by these British sensors, who could block, you know, they could do, you know, conduct surveillance as a kind of censorship, but they could also collect They could also use, you know, surveillance as a kind of, you know, signals intelligence. I mean, there are two main strands within mass surveillance, I would say. I can talk about that later, perhaps. But I mean, this information was usually then summarized in daily reports that were sent to, I think, 212 different branches of the British government.
Wow.
By the end of the war, it started at a relatively discreet level. I think in the beginning it was primarily aimed for you know, counterintelligence, you know, battling German spies traveling through the British Empire. But then the number of assignments grew and grew and grew and grew, and the mandate of the censors grew and grew and grew and grew.
Just to allow me to understand this, so you said that they had technologies that could monitor the content of all these telegrams, but was that automated, like the way that you know, you'd have machine learning filter internet communications today, or did they have to have like human eyes read through this? Because that's a massive undertaking.
Yeah, it was pretty manual and hands-on. People reading messages, and people, of course, you get, after a while, you get telephonic censorship as well in most countries, not least in Scandinavia. Then you have telephone operators listening in on suspicious conversations, making notes. But it's very manual, eyes and ears.
Yeah.
No machines at this time. You have crypto machines and decrypting machines for handling codes, encrypted content, cracking codes and so on. But the actual surveillance, the actual, you know, evaluation of the content is very much based on the human eye and mind at this time.
Yeah. It's obviously not surprising that during wartime, governments will be very concerned about countering spies. They will want to pick up communication from the enemy if they have plans about invasion or stuff like that. But other types of information would also come within the remit and be interesting. And, you know, today we have these huge discussions about disinformation and fake news and propaganda. And that very much also becomes part of the era of mass surveillance and the concerns of these eyes and ears. How so?
Yeah, the telegraph turned into a tool of propaganda during World War One. World War One is a game changer in many, many ways. Of course, you know, it's sort of, you know, the basic disaster that creates the modern world, the modern 20th century. You get mass surveillance as well as mass propaganda.
Yeah,
and the new kinds of propaganda that are created during World War One are usually very subtle, disguised as ordinary news items, not least news telegrams, that are, you know, created and sprouted out en masse through these global communication networks, not least to neutral parts like the Scandinavian countries and, of course, the United States, where these slightly biased telegrams, you know, were published in ordinary newspapers and used to, you know, sway public opinion in favor of, you know, one side of the war.
Yeah. Basically, if you run a newspaper in Copenhagen or New York or Washington, and then you rely on cables to cover foreign affairs because you might not have a huge network of correspondents.
I mean, having a foreign correspondent at this time at an ordinary newspaper was an extreme luxury. It was very, very It was very expensive.
Yeah.
So, but still, you had to have a war section during the Great War. You had to have telegrams from the front, from the frontier. So they were heavily dependent on these news agencies. News agencies such as the British Reuters, which turned into, obviously, a British propaganda tool during World War One. There have been tendencies before, already during the First Crimean War in the 1850s. But I mean, it was closely connected to, you know, the British propaganda ministry, which was called Ministry of Information, that was created in 1917.
A very nice Orwellian ring to it.
It has a touch. It has a touch. but you had the German counterpart, Wolf's Telegram Bureau. You had the French Havas, and of course, after a while, you also got Associated Press, the AP, turned into an American propaganda central after 1917.
So, how overt was this propaganda? Was it that governments, like the British government, could tell Reuters you should put out these cables, or was it more a manipulation of the editors? How did it work?
I think it was pretty direct. I mean, the Ministry of Information actually, I mean, it started out in a more improvised way, of course, but I mean, it was actually quite centralized by the end of the war, also in a country such as Great Britain, which was mastering the craft of public propaganda at that time. So there were very, very close connections between the Ministry of Information and Reuters.
Okay.
They were acting on orders from the Ministry of Information, so thereby on orders from the British government.
So one thing is, if Reuters is ordered to publish certain telegrams sort of relaying the British narrative, but would they also be told that there were information that they could not publish because it was not in the British interest to...
In domestic newspapers, or you mean abroad?
Yes, of course.
I mean, that was one of the points of this censorship system. I mean, they were told so, of course, but you had another level of protection as well, and that was the censors. I mean, the cable censors.
Yeah.
I mean, this was a very a clandestine form of censorship that was continuous. They sifted through the channels of communication with the pure purpose, or with the overriding purpose of, you know, manipulating public opinion worldwide in Allied favor.
Uh-huh. So basically, if they picked up on a telegram, a news telegram, and they said this is not in Britain's interest, that they would quietly censor it and make sure that it didn't attract wide circulation.
I found many examples of that in my material.
Yeah.
British, German, Scandinavian, what have you not.
Do you have a good example of a telegram that was or information that was quietly dumped?
I think my favorite, that is not a news item, but still, can I mention it?
Yes, of course.
It is a telegram that was handed in at the Central Telegraph Station in Copenhagen in early December 1914 by someone from the Turkish consulate.
Mm-hmm.
Turk was at this time an ally of Germany, the Central Powers. And it was written in German, and the content was that, first, it was written in German to the Imperial Naval Ministry in Berlin. And the content was that a Russian Jew who's residing in Copenhagen has sent a ship, now has sent a load of 5,000 sacks of cabbage to Petrograd in Russia with a Swedish steamer with Swedish ship papers, Captain Svensson. Stop. And that telegram caused a very, very intense correspondence between the Telegraph Directory and one of the undersecretaries of state at the foreign ministry.
Okay.
Well, they found out after a while that the best thing to do was to let this telegram discreetly disappear. That is a direct quote. A diskret försvinna.
Okay.
Discreetly disappear. And the foreign ministry's secretary of state asked the telegraph director to keep the person who sent this telegram under close monitoring.
Okay.
And I'm still struggling with the content.
That either it's very sophisticated code or it's completely trivial.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what it is. I mean, 5,000 sacks of cabbage could be, you know, grenades or whatever. But still, in the context of war, 5,000 sacks of cabbage could be strategically important as well.
Yeah.
I mean, it's food for the men, for the troops.
Yeah.
So I think so. But the many examples of that, but also concerning journalists and politicians. A guy who was closely monitored in Denmark was Stauning.
Yeah, who was a later prime minister for the Social Democrats.
Exactly. And he, for various reasons, but I mean, he maintained very close relations to his German and Austrian Social Democratic colleagues.
Yeah.
So he was considered to be a little bit too German friendly.
Yeah. Okay.
So all his telegrams were being closely monitored by Danish and also Swedish and Norwegian cable censors because they had this very close Scandinavian censorship agreement.
And was he aware of this? Or
no.
No.
That is not my impression.
Okay.
But I mean, you have also Scandinavian journalists and publishers and editors like Kauling.
Yeah.
The editor of Politiken at the time, he was on this watch list that I found, which
the
is
Danish,
literally
Danish newspaper.
Exactly, the big Danish newspaper at that time. Still, of course, the big radical. His name was on this blacklist. It was literally called a blacklist. And I think the reason for that was that his newspaper was also considered to be a little bit pro-German,
okay,
for various reasons. I've read that the Telegram editor, the guy at Politiken who was responsible for publishing telegrams from the front, frontier, war telegrams, he was paid by the German embassy in Copenhagen to, you know, give priority to German-friendly telegrams.
Okay.
And the foreign minister was aware of that.
Okay.
Hence, he was on the watch list.
Those are great examples. Of course, some telegrams that were intercepted, or at least one particular one, helped change history and the course of World War One. That is the famous Zimmermann telegram. So
yes,
that's a fascinating story. Can you add some color to that one?
Yeah, I mean, it's basically the telegram that changed the world, the course of history, you could say. Started in January 1917 when the German foreign minister, Arthur Zimmermann, penned a telegram to the Mexican government containing a secret scheme for a military alliance between Germany and Mexico in the event that the United States of America would become a part of the Allied forces when Germany implemented the new strategy of unrestricted submarine warfare.
Mm-hmm.
There was a great risk that this strategy would also result in a lot of sunken American ships.
Yes.
So they had to take a precaution. So this secret scheme was enclosed in an encrypted telegram, heavily encrypted with a new super advanced diplomatic code. It was sent by landline cable telegram from Berlin to Copenhagen, from Copenhagen to Fredericia, from Fredericia to Sonneby, over the North Sea to England, and then across the Atlantic on this famous transatlantic cable to Washington. And there it was decrypted and recrypted into a less advanced code,
mm-hmm,
as the Mexican, the German embassy in Mexico did not have access to this super diplomatic code. And then it was sent to the German ambassador to Mexico and so on. But on the way to America, even before it entered the transatlantic cable, it was intercepted by British cable sensors. I mean, they intercepted everything that passed through British cables, especially stuff that was everything. But I mean, stuff that was encrypted was especially suspicious, of course,
yes, of course,
then as well as today. And it was forwarded by the sensors to this secretive, very enigmatic intelligence unit at the British Admiralty called Room 40,
mm-hmm,
which was basically the predecessor of Bletchley Park and the government communications headquarters. And they took them, you know, about a night's work to, you know, to reveal the content, to crack the code, reveal the content, this secret scheme containing wonderful formulations like, let's make war together. Germany will help you to reconquer lost territory in Arizona, New Mexico, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And this content was leaked to Woodrow Wilson's administration through, you know, of course, the American Embassy in London. Woodrow Wilson was very upset. He leaked it to to Associated Press, who sent it out as a, you know, news item, the translated version of the telegram. So it sort of it was published in American media like in late February 1917, where it really, you know, whipped up this shitstorm against Germany.
Of course.
And created a very strong anti-German sentiment in, you know, U.S. media.
Yeah, so it could help the effort to create support for American involvement.
Exactly, to evaporate American isolationism and so on. And of course, Woodrow Wilson used this Zimmermann telegram as one of many causes of war when he addressed Congress there in April 1917. He said that this shows that the Kaiser German has very treacherous intentions and they are trying to stir up enemies against us at our very doors. So we can't rely on, we can't trust in Germany. We need to go to war, basically.
So both during and after the war, governments found out that mass surveillance could also be used against their own population. So you already alluded to the fact that there's this scope creep, if you like, that it goes from being sort of very narrow, aimed at counterintelligence and very narrowly national security interests. But then when you have those kinds of instruments, there might be other things that you'd like. Can you describe some of the other types of information? We already talked about disinformation and so on, but it seems to me that there might have been even broader use of mass surveillance.
One use that sort of evolved during the war and became very important by the end of the war was the channels of communication for making mood reports about the population. That was a very, very big thing in Europe, especially in Scandinavia, actually, where you had this fear of Bolsheviks after the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917. You know, many of these techniques that started out as pure censorship tools for, you know, manipulating public discourse and or for checking, you know, the loyalty of soldiers at the frontier and so on, letter censorship, started to be used for compiling mood reports about, you know, attitudes within the wider population in relation to specific topics, not least socialism.
Yeah. After World War One, government did not just sit back and say, well, we needed these instruments because there was an emergency. Instead, they were further developed to target new communications, including the rapid development of radio. I think you even talk about a radio war in the 1930s. Yes. Who were the combatants in this war and how did it play out?
Yes. First, I think I need to say that each new innovation within the field of communication and communications technologies has created new fears amongst governments and security services for, you know, treacherous transnational communication.
Moral panics, if you like.
Exactly. Within the system, security-related moral panics. But radio has always been, as long as it has existed, particularly problematic for various reasons. One of them being that radio is really, by its very essence, transnational. These radio waves, they do not respect physical borders, and they do not respect national borders, and they are invisible. It's very, very difficult to control radio-based wireless communication. That's why radio or wireless communication was so heavily restricted during World War One. But at that time, radio apparatuses, these devices, the radio senders and receivers, they were big, behemoth-like monstrosities. I mean, the guy next door did not have a radio in his basement. That was something that, you know, the technological avant-garde used, especially state agents and innovators of various kinds. In the 1920s, you get shortwave radio. And that creates the possibilities of making pretty small and cheap radio apparatuses that can be bought by anyone, basically. And they're very efficient, much more efficient for, you know, long-distance communication than the old-time long-wave equipment. So you get the beginning of this radio ham culture, where you have, you know, radio amateurs buying radio sets, sitting in attics and so on, communicating with the whole world, collecting call signals and impressions. It's a very, very transnational, cosmopolitan, tech-based culture. You can compare it a bit to, you know, like, you know, the World Wide Web avant-garde in the early 1990s. But of course, it creates loads of fears amongst governments and government authorities, not least all these security services, which are mushrooming throughout the world, not least in war traumatized Europe after the Versailles Treaty.
Yeah, you can understand that. I mean, they just found out a way to control the telegraph and build this huge, massive apparatus, and then these geeks come along and then they create shortwave radio.
Yes, exactly. The cable telegraph had opened up a new frontier in warfare, informational warfare, but you could still contain it somehow. This new incarnation or iteration is invisible, literally speaking, is coming from anywhere. And it's opening a front line of war, which sort of, you know, creates a scar that goes into, you know, ordinary people's homes. So these governments, they are fearing radio receivers and senders used for espionage activities, but also various kinds of fake news and propaganda measures. I mean, Goebbels starts his transnational propaganda machine pretty early after the German takeover in 1933. And I think the Bolshevik starts even earlier with, you know, transnational propaganda transmissions. I think it's already in 1925 that they get this Radio Moscow that sends, you know, so-called black propaganda, black as well as white propaganda. I mean, white in being open, this is... I'm a Bolshevik. Yeah. I want you to make a revolution, so on. But also black, hidden,
With subtle.
So more subtle. Usually transmitted in the language of the receivers.
Yeah,
like in Swedish for a Swedish audience.
Striking similarities to today, where we fear, for instance, RT.
Yes.
Or Sputnik, like Russian state-sponsored media outlets that craft pro-Kremlin messages in British English or American to audiences in democracies.
Exactly. You have state actors, but you also have this enormous, this plethora of individual actors who are very difficult to control. These radio hams, they are not only sending, you know, Morse code and so on. They usually, they can send anything, music. It's a very, the lines of demarcation between, a radio producer and radio receiver they are usually quite blurry at this time. It's really a radio chaos over the ether in Europe in the 1920s and 1930s. So these public broadcasting systems that are well-ordered with well-ordered frequencies and so on, they are primarily a construction of, the post-war period, after World War II.
Okay.
And this creates all kinds of anxieties amongst government authorities, of course. So you get these authorities who are policing the ether, scanning the ether for illicit transmissions. People who don't have paid, people haven't paid their license. I mean, ordinary, harmless but non-license paying radio hams, but also more treacherous, suspicious actors such as spies and propaganda makers and political radicals who are either sending, transmitting, or relaying dangerous propaganda, because you have to remember that this is also the age of political extremism.
Yeah.
I mean, the age of extremes. We're talking the rise of Stalinist communism and, of course, Nazism and Italian fascism.
Apart from scanning, what do governments do in order to try and control and push back against this phenomenon? Are there laws that restrict the use of radio? Or what do you do when you're a government who can no longer control the flow of information as you once could?
Yes, they are trying to, through various means. Of course, it becomes forbidden to use the amateur frequencies by the outbreak of World War II throughout Europe.
Yeah,
we have loads of interesting materials about that here in the Enigma archive. I mean, the very radio hams who are very, very upset about this. I mean, radio machines are either, sealed or confiscated, or even worse things, they are destroyed. So it's really, from their point of view, it's really an outrageous infringement of their rights as citizens.
In the wrong hands, these instruments of mass surveillance was a very potent weapon. You already alluded to Nazi Germany and the propaganda there. You quote a historian in one of your papers that Nazi Germany exploited mass surveillance, quote, to give the government and the dominant party, i.e. the Nazi Party, such far-reaching insight into the thoughts, feelings, and aspirations of the entire German people as had never been known in all history.
That's a fantastic quotation,
yes.
I think.
Can you give some more detail to how they did this?
Yeah, but they, first of all, Nazi surveillance was not very efficient. It was very complex and partially incoherent, because you had these different kinds of surveillance apparatuses working simultaneously. You had the Gestapo, you had SS and Sicherheitsdienst, and you had this very suspicious, enigmatic research office of the Air Ministry, which was led by Hermann Göring.
Yeah.
And that was the most high-tech oriented kind of surveillance. I mean, they created a system with intercept stations and listening posts, and also cabinets noirs, letter opening bureaus all over Germany in the beginning, at these key points in the German communications infrastructure, domestically, but also, and that was probably the most crucial thing, at these national transnational junctions where you had these communication streams going in and out of the Third Reich. And the ideal, at least, was to penetrate all communication, also communication from leaders. Mm-hmm. It was used against, it was used during the Night of the Long Knives, for instance, against Röhm and the SA. But it was also used against, you know, groups such as Jews, communists, social democrats. So it was really a kind of mass surveillance. But luckily for the Germans, I mean, you had this constant rivalry between all these Nazi figures fighting for being in the Führer's favor. So they had this problem with connecting the dots.
Yeah.
SS didn't really communicate with the Forschungsamt. So, you know, all this information that was collected, most of it, some of it at least, it's very difficult to tell occasionally when you're talking about Nazi German, because so much of the material was, you know, consciously destroyed by the Nazis themselves. But my impression, by reading the research literature, is that much of this information collected was not used for anything, luckily, because they had problems. You know, they had this problem, constant problem with information overload. They collected loads of information, but they didn't have the analytical tools, or maybe the cognitive skills for using it in an efficient way.
We shouldn't compare Nazi Germany with 21st century America, but it's still, you had some of the same problems prior to 9/11, I guess.
CIA, FBI.
I mean, they had lots of information, but they just weren't unable to connect the dots.
Yeah.
But can we then say that despite the Brits really being the architects of mass surveillance, you said they primarily used it for the transnational communications, whereas the Nazi Germany then said, we're going to use this on our own population in scrupulous details.
Yeah, in a way, but still there were tendencies also in the liberal democratic Britain and also liberal democratic Scandinavia at that time in the 1930s. I mean, you saw a massive expansion of these surveillance regimes all over Europe and also in the United States. In the of course the USSR, and also in the democratic states. I think that's very important. I mean, there are two kinds of, I mean, surveillance is an intrinsic feature of statecraft.
Yeah, in one of your books, is it like the Elizabethan era, Elizabeth I of England, whom you credit as being sort of the first to really use it, as systematize it?
Yeah, exactly. One of the first absolute regents.
Yeah.
Who put it in practice. But it's an intrinsic feature of modern statecraft. You need some kind of surveillance, otherwise you don't have a coherent state. You don't have this state monopoly on violence that you need in order to avoid, you know, constant civil warfare. So you have surveillance measures also in democratic states. And these regimes are heavily expanded in the 1930s for the purpose of defending democracy against undemocratic actors. And there is a paradox in that, of course.
Yeah.
And luckily, the governments, at least in Denmark and Sweden, are aware of that. They are aware of that paradox. They know that if you go too far, if you, you know, erode the borders, the barriers between the private sphere and the state sphere, you erode democracy.
Yeah.
You need that private sphere in order to, you know, have a place where you can cultivate your opinions and for freedom of speech and so on. So that is a constant problem in the democratic states that have haunted them ever since. That paradox, that atavism. That is not a problem. That is a golden opportunity in the totalitarian state.
Yeah. Who have no qualms about.
Exactly. If you look at the German case, you have, of course, Nazi Germany, you have the DDR. They used this erosion of the barriers between the private sphere and the state sphere. I mean, that was ideologically logical for them. Yeah. I mean, that's how you create a totalitarian state, a total state. You don't have any sense of privacy. It was used in order to create fear, constant fear in society. So they could go, you know, all in a way that is impossible in a democratic state. They can talk about it openly. They did talk about it openly because propaganda, this is maybe dangerous territory that I'm entering now. But I mean, I could assume, and that would be a very interesting topic for an article, but that the surveillance systems in Scandinavia were in many ways probably more efficient than in the case of Germany, at least during the Nazi period. But they bragged about it in another way. They talked about it openly, and they used it in a much more brutal way in Nazi Germany, because that was a logical consequence of Nazi ideology.
Yeah, because you don't have rule of law, you don't have checks and balances, you don't have fundamental freedoms that act as a restraint.
Whereas in Scandinavia, we have, you know, the Swedish liberty of speech goes back to 1766. Mm. In Denmark, you have the students appeared in the 1770s. Yeah. I mean, and of course, the inviolability of the dwelling and so on and so forth. The constitution. You have all this. I mean, it's a part of the ideological constitutional DNA in our part of the world that this is problematic. And that has been a constant glitch, I would say, a constant haunting in our societies, at least since, World War One.
It's very interesting because today Germany is obviously a committed democracy, but in the digital era, Germany is among the European democracies that are most concerned about propaganda and hate speech and so on online. So the current government has adopted laws that orders private tech companies to remove illegal content or face fines. So here again, you see this blurring between private and public, obviously nothing comparable to Nazi Germany. And the reason they do it is obviously to avoid relapse. I guess there's no way of avoiding this dilemma once a state you decide to use more blunt measures to combat illiberal ideas.
I mean, that dilemma is unavoidable. And the only thing you can do about it is to address it constantly, publicly. You have to do that.
Yeah. You have to be aware of the territory you're entering and how far you want to go.
Exactly. Yeah. Because I think the big problem today with the surveillance, first of all, it's older than democracy, which is potentially more fragile than these surveillance systems. Secondly, you have this paradox that makes it into a double-edged sword. If you want to combat undemocratic forces, you can turn yourself into an undemocratic state if you use it, if you go too far. And the third point today, which has been there all the time, but it's even more explicit today, is that these surveillance systems are technologically very, very complex. They're really black box entities. Input is definitely not always compatible with output. You don't understand what these systems do. They get a life of their own.
Yeah.
That was the fact in the early 20th century, World War One, and even more so today, when you have this third new actor, the tech companies, internet companies such as Google and Facebook, of course, who have sort of, you know, an agenda of their own. And even more advanced technologies such as artificial intelligence and so on, which makes them, I mean, they really have a life of their own, these systems.
Yeah. And that brings me to my next question. So what are the main similarities and differences between the mass surveillance systems built during World War One and those of today? Is it a matter of degree or how should we view it?
Yeah, it's a difficult question. In a way, it's all a matter of degree and a quantitative change. Many of these methods and measures, they are the same. I mean, cable tapping of the underlying cable infrastructure is still very big today in our sky-based world. I mean, the NSA, GCHQ, they are still tapping cables, now fiber optic cables. That's a major similarity. A second major similarity is that you have all these special arrangements of back doors between intelligence services, governments on the one hand, and, you know, communications providers and operators on the other hand. In the early 20th century, it was AT&T, Western Union, British Post Office, and so on, and Eastern and Associated Telegraph Company. Today it is Facebook, Google, and so on and so forth. But I think a difference, but there is still a difference in degrees, is of course that they're much more complicated today. They're much more, you know, as technical, socio-technical systems. They are much more impenetrable for the people who are operating them today than they were in the early 20th century.
Yeah.
And of course, the rise of the tech giants. I find them very difficult to comprehend as a historian. I don't know how to categorize them yet.
No.
Are they just companies? Clearly not. Can they be compared to, I don't know, these big trading companies in the East India Company, for instance, 17th century, 18th, 19th century? Maybe. They were some kind of proto-states as well.
Yeah.
Or are they actually just some kind of proto-state, a new kind of state actor? We don't recognize them for what they are, but they clearly have some kind of state power. I mean, include, exclude, they exercise censorship. They have some kind of virtual territory, which is very closely intertwined with physical territory. They can exclude people from, you know, from society, from the virtual society, include people from society. They spread news. So soon they also have their own currency. I mean, so there are definitely... That's a very interesting, intriguing factor that is very difficult to comprehend for a historian. I think they would probably make up for some kind of qualitative difference, not only quantitative.
But also because I guess you can glance a lot from a telegram and if you listen in on a telephone conversation, but the amounts and nature of data that a Google or that a Facebook has about you allows whoever has access to that data a much more intrusive picture of who you are as a person. So basically their business model is that they know more about us than we do ourselves.
Yeah, exactly. But I still think that, of course, big data is a consequence of, this constantly growing use of the internet, World Wide Web, and the cell phone, of course, for the past 30 years. But these methods that these tech giants are using are quite similar to the methods used by, you know, signals intelligence units such as Bletchley Park. I mean, they were also doing traffic analysis and they were, you know, scanning aggregated masses of data for, you know, patterns and deviations to these patterns, deviation from the normal routes and so on. What do we have here? They don't act the same way as they acted yesterday. How can we use that to make prognostications about future behavior?
Mm.
I mean, the intelligence units or services did that in the 20th century, and that is used today by tech companies for commercial reasons.
Again, a matter of degree in the sophistication of the algorithms, if you like.
Yeah, probably. Yes, of course.
To my last question, we've already discussed it a bit, but I think there's something very interesting about the fact that it was Britain, which was one of few democracies, but supposedly the shining light of liberal democracy in the early 20th century, that built the matrix for global surveillance and censorship, much like the US has done in the digital age, where the US has taken over the role of Britain as sort of the sole superpower, see how long that lasts, and the supposed leader of the free world. So what does that tell us? Should we be more suspicious about the intentions and activities of even the most liberal and democratic states when it comes to censorship and communication controls?
You mean compared to totalitarian states? US compared to China, for instance?
Yeah. Do we have those bright lines that we would say that democracies promote these values of freedom and transparency, whereas authoritarian states are the opposite? And just in general, should we as citizens have our guards up more than we might have when we think about democracies?
Yeah. No, but it goes back to this paradox, to this atavism. How do you pronounce it in English? Atavism.
Yeah,
I think it's something that has been inherited from historical periods, so it's sort of, anachronistic today. I mean, this the surveillance system is in many ways an anachronism, in many, many ways. It's very undemocratic and it's incompatible in many ways with rule of law and freedom of expression and the right to privacy. But you still need it in order to defend democracy, in order to defend the state, the power of the state. And that is an all-encompassing problem of global statecraft that goes for democracies as well as for totalitarian regimes. But again, it's not a problem for totalitarian regimes. They don't have to deal with this. To them, it is only an opportunity.
Mm.
So, of course, we have to be aware. We have to, you know, of this problem. We have to constantly criticize our own governments. And, of course, especially the leader of the free world. Because, I mean, these what did you call them? The bright lines.
Yeah.
They do not exist. But we still need them as a compass. We need them as ideals, I think, if we want to, you know, to live in a free and democratic world, especially as these systems are unavoidable, but they also have this self-expanding, constantly mission creep-based tendency. They constantly grow if we don't expose them, take them out into the, you know, to the sunlight and, you know, force our, you know, politicians to do something about the problem. They would just continue to grow.
Andreas, this has been absolutely riveting and very informative. Thank you very much for taking the time to enlighten us.
Thank you.